So first of all, have people read my Ultimate Healing Handbook that was on the website? Most of them, hopefully. So I'm going to go over some of the basics of it again, so you're not what you're working with. Because you're working with a principle that everything in the body is reflected by something first in consciousness that's getting crystallised into the body. So I'll be explaining a bit about how that works again, so you know where you're starting from. Well, first of all, if you look at the whole creation myth, how the goddess first blew a bubble of her love, it's about 300 billion light years across, it's only a small bubble for the goddess. And in that bubble, she breathed love, her first energy of life, which is that of beauty. Now, this bubble is like a three-dimensional hologram. You know, with holograms, when you shine a light on it, an image appears. With spherical holograms, when you put a little beam into it, you get multiple reflections that creates a whole complex world inside it. This is very much how the universe works. It's a spherical hologram. When energy comes in, it creates these reflections, it creates these images. All these images are created out of interference patterns of light. Physics has shown that nothing is really physical. A wave becomes a particle when it's observed. Observing it is what localizes it. Nothing is there until it's observed. So that's the first part of understanding how consciousness creates reality. Observation is what turns energy into matter. Nothing is there until you observe it. This whole picture of the spherical hologram works on a more individual level as well. Our aura is like a hologram. Our bodies are created by interference of pattern of light, by the waves set up within that hologram. All our thoughts, all our emotions, everything we experience as our energy pattern then creates the body. Okay, that gets a bit abstract until we start looking at the DNA to see how this actually crystallises. So when I jump from the quantum physics back down to the simple physical structure of the DNA. As you know, DNA is a coil, double coil actually, it's two coils wrapping around each other. And they're kind of linked together by many little threads between them. And this coil will conduct energy. Every experience we have, every thought, every emotion, is an electrical impulse. It goes down the DNA. It goes down one strand and up the other, which means every impulse goes in both directions at once. Gives rise to what we call a scalar wave. There's no direction. A scalar wave is a standing wave pattern, no direction. So every thought, every feeling, every impulse we have is first creating a wave in the DNA in the body. This wave then is storing a certain energy pattern. And there are several ways that can go. First of all, once we experience it and it goes through our senses and becomes integrated, it'll pass through the corpus callosum of the brain, which is the bit between the left and right hemispheres. Now, I wanted to make a little Möbius strip here so I can explain the structure. Get a bit of paper and just fold it up. Show you the shape of what's inside your brain. Between the two hemispheres, you get this little strip, which twists on itself like that.
Can you hold it up so people can see it?
So rather than just being a closed loop, it twists. That's what you call a Möbius strip.
Can you see that?
Twisted bit of band. That's what you've got in the middle of your brain, between the hemispheres. So any wave going around this coil, because of its structure, will go through 180-degree phase change. Now, I know with waves, if you wave this way, another one 180 degrees out of phase, they're going to cancel each other out, neutralise, there's nothing there. Which means once something's gone through the brain, it's no longer in the DNA. It means when any experience is consciously experienced, it's finished. Until it's consciously experienced, it's still in the DNA. This is why the DNA gets full of suppressed experiences. Anything you don't consciously experience that you push away is still in the DNA as a scalar wave. Now, this scalar wave is going to produce a crystal simply because it draws energy. It draws matter from around itself by its electrical charge. What it produces is actually a protein-melanin complex that creates a kind of little crystal, just like an organic computer chip that's full of stored memory. So all your suppressed emotions and thoughts and experiences form little crystals in the DNA. Now, this will be the same in every DNA molecule in the body because they're all holding the same pattern. So it's not just in one part of the body, it's holographic. However, there's a reflex between, well, it's like a resonance between the different coils of DNA, a chakra system, endocrine glands, all in the same kind of structure of seven layers. So to explain how we suppress experience in layers. First of all, when you experience life with enthusiasm, there is no resistance. Enthusiasm, when you break it down, means God in you. Ent is in. Who is an ancient name for God. But also, it's beyond our concept of God. It was in a magical word from Egypt, which was meant the creative force of the universe. When you're in enthusiasm, you're fully present. You're in a space of creation. When you begin to suppress experience, you start to close that down. The first level of resistance is pain. Pain is there any time things are other than you want them to be, basically. So we first create the universe without judgment. Reasonably, well, simply because you haven't got any experience yet, you don't know what's good or bad. You simply create things to see what it's like. There's no judgment at that point. When you certain things you find you don't like, when you find things other than you want them to be, you have pain. So you start making judgments. This is good, this is bad, I don't like this. You begin to resist things. When you get tired of a thing that you don't like, you're going to get angry. Anger is, first of all, there to make you assertive, so you change it. But there's still a level of resistance. You're angry because of something you don't like. When you give up being angry, you're going to fear, because you're afraid the situation is going to continue. Things will always be the way you don't like it. After you get tired of the fear, you push into grief. In the state of grief, you simply on the victim level, where everything is bad and so you're sad. You're no longer being aware that you're creating it. Then you push into apathy, where you don't even know what the original problem was, but you've given up. And then finally you push it down into unconsciousness, where you numb out and no longer experience the problem. So there's a scale of 7 emotions here. Enthusiasm, pain, anger, fear, grief, apathy, unconsciousness, which relates to the 7 coils of the DNA. Also relates to the 7 chakras and to the 7 endocrine glands. So when your pineal gland resonates with enthusiasm, when you're enthusiastic, your pineal gland's working. And that starts closing down very early in life. Most children, the pineal gland is calcified by the age of 6. Mm-hmm. It's usually about the time you go to school. They start cramming things into you and closing you down rather than actually educating you. It's all the conditioning closes it down. People no longer freely flowing with life. Pain resonates with the pituitary gland. You'll find that when you actually release the pituitary gland, it actually rebuilds nerve pathways to paralysed areas of the body. So once you experience the pain, the body can heal. When the pain is suppressed into the body, things are not working. The nerves shut down. Function as well as sensitivity are lost. Anger goes into the thyroid gland. So when that calcifies, you get things like arthritis and rheumatism. Fear goes into the thymus gland, which affects the immune system. Grief goes into the pancreas, adrenals, and solar plexus. Apathy goes to the spleen, then consciousness to the gonads. That's the testicle and prostate in man, ovary and uterus in a woman. So when you start releasing, you release from the bottom up. First out comes the unconsciousness. You simply experience that as being numb in the body and floaty in the mind. All your memories of anaesthetics and things come out first. If you've been under anaesthetic, you know what that's like. When it comes out, you feel really numb, really floaty, hardly stay awake. And that's okay. If you experience that, it's being released. You see, most people are unconscious of being unconscious. I think this is normal. So when you first experience it, you're becoming conscious of being unconscious. You experience the numbness and the floatiness and the distance. When it's passed, it's all over. You then move up into apathy. Although you're not unconscious anymore, you feel really lacking of energy, can't be bothered because everything's got too much. You feel, remember all the overwhelms in life where you gave up? You go through that as well enthusiastically. So the trick then is to be enthusiastic about being apathetic. Because the more enthusiastic you are, the more you move up the scale. Every emotion you're enthusiastic about, you move through faster. So when you're numb, you'd be enthusiastic about being numb. When you're in apathy, you become enthusiastic about being apathetic. What that means is that when you feel like giving up, you'd really get into that. You just love the feeling you just want to give up and do nothing and everything's too much. You experience it. Things with emotions, you recognise that they are emotions, they're not truths. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. A lot of people experience an emotion, think this is how it is. No, this is an emotion. You're feeling angry, you're feeling apathy, you're feeling pain, whatever. That's okay, you feel that. When you're feeling apathy, it doesn't mean that everything is really useless and hopeless, but you can feel that way. When you feel it enthusiastically, you pass through it and you come at the other end. So in the apathy, you simply come to be very enthusiastic about your apathy and really get into wallowing and feeling like giving up and everything is hopeless and nothing's going to work. When you come out of that, you go into grief. Then you remember all the things that have hurt you and all the pain and the grief and tears come out. And after that, you go into fear. Again, you just feel the fear enthusiastically. You realise you're not about to get hurt, really. Your life isn't really going to blow up in your face, even though you feel like it's going to happen. It's just fear. You welcome that, it passes. Then you get into the anger. You remember all the times you've been angry with somebody else because you weren't getting your way. All the times you need to assert yourself and didn't. Because that's what anger is really about, is assertiveness. When you're angry, it's because you know you need to change something. And quite often you don't, because you didn't have the power, something's crushed you, and the anger's been pushed inside. When it comes out, you're going to get angry, and that's okay. You feel the anger until it passes, and then you're going to get to the pain. With pain, memory is more complete. With anger, it's one-sided. You're always remembering your side of the story with anger. But turning you're going to pain, you're going to be on judgment. You simply experience pain as it was. Something there you didn't like. Okay, once you know that, you won't create it again. What's happening, you see, we first create a reality. But if you don't finish with that creation, you're still held in a constant state of creation. By forgetting you're creating it, you're no longer able to control it. So all the things you resist are happening again. So when you get to this level of pain, you remember all the things in your life that are hurtful. You also reach a point where you've gone beyond the judgment. You're no longer angry about it, but you simply realise that hurts. When you welcome the pain and release it, you've entered the separation. You've moved up to the enthusiasm, but you're back into your creative force. So all this is also related to a process of creation. A lot of people know in any way that we create our own reality. But when it comes down to doing it, it gets more complex than that. Because we held so many things in the state of creation, that we're no longer responsible for them. We don't know how we're creating it. We like to pretend we're not. So if something happens that's hurtful and you don't know why you created it, remember, it's simply because pure awareness can play any game without judgment. When you first created it, there was no judgment. You didn't know what it was like yet. It's only after you've created it you decided that you didn't like it. So when you go through these painful experiences where your consciousness has been trapped and you've numbed out, when that pain comes up, you're back to a position where you can create consciously. So what happens when we create things and don't finish them? They're all lying in the unconscious, and every time you try and create something new, it causes all the old creations to reassert themselves. This is why when you start wanting to create something new, put another thought, all these other thoughts arise in the background, all the doubts and things from things that didn't happen before. It's no good trying to push them back down, because you're pushing back to the unconscious where it's in a state of creation. When you want to create something, you must first release all the old creations, so you're free to create anew. Have a lot of you done exercises of creation where you visualise something and want it to happen? This is quite standard New Age stuff, where you all know about it. And what happens? You find when you put out a good thought, all the negative ones start arising. All your doubts in the past, this is never going to happen. Might put out a thought, I'm going to get rich now. Thought comes up, no you're not. It's simply past creations reasserting themselves. When you welcome those and get them out of the way, they're gone. So when a thought comes up, now you're not. You remember all the past times things didn't work. All the apathy comes up, all the grief. Once you release that, then you say, I'm going to get rich. So no more other thoughts coming up because they've gone. We can call those secondary creations. Every time you put out a thought, these secondaries start arising. So we have to use this process. So it's not just when you're going through therapy and healing, but in your process of creation. Every time you want to create something, put out a new thought, this old stuff arises. So you're going to need to know how to get rid of it. And you do it by first welcoming it. You see, there are certain stages consciousness has in exploring reality. Although our brains get very complex in how they do things, pure awareness only does three things. It creates, experiences, and then discreates when it's finished with it. Problem with not getting to discreation is because we haven't finished experiencing. So I don't like this, I'm not experiencing more, I'm going to push it away. But actually, once you've created something, you have to experience it for this wave to go back from the body through the brain, then it's done, it's gone. And then you can discreate it. So where this works consciously, let's do it in stages. First you need to know how to welcome an emotion. And the problem people have is that they identify with the emotions. If it's no longer something you're feeling but what you are, you don't know how to welcome it and release it. And let's look at how people identify with emotions. They might, for instance, say, I'm an angry person, rather than I'm feeling angry. But remember, the emotion isn't who you are. It doesn't make any difference to what you are. You're not a bad person to be angry and a good person when you're not angry. You're still the same. The emotion is not you. You can experience any emotion at different times. We all experience emotions that make no difference to what you really are. The emotion is not you. So we have to first separate from the emotion by experiencing it as an emotion rather than what you are. Give an example of how that works. Take something in your hand, a pen will do, and just squeeze it in your hand, nice and tightly. Just so you know what it's like, grab your pen and hold it. You squeeze it really tightly until your knuckles are turning white. You may find after a while that you can't tell where your hand ends and where the pen begins. So just do it until you feel that. You start losing boundary. If you want to know where the pen is and where your hand is, you have to let go a little bit and let it be there. Now you can feel it. Oh, there's the pen. It's not you anymore. And then you can drop it. Now you do the same thing with emotions. So after a pen exercise, try it with emotion. Think of something you felt sometime in your life or recently when you were upset or angry or whatever. If you remember it, can you get in touch with the emotion? And can you do the same thing you did with the pen? Let the emotion be there. Instead of gripping onto it and thinking it's you, let it go and let it be there. Whatever it's angry, say, okay, there's anger. Just feel it. Can you welcome it? Let it be there. Nothing wrong with feeling it, it's just an emotion. And as you welcome it, you notice it already begins to change. And after a while it passes. The first stage is not to identify. Instead of gripping onto it and thinking this is me, you let go and let it be there. So you learn to welcome the emotion first. None of the emotions are really a problem to feel when you realise they're just emotions. You can feel your numbness, you can feel your apathy, you can feel your grief, feel your fear, feel your anger, feel your pain. You recognise that's just an emotion, I can feel that. So you welcome it. That's the first step. What happens when you welcome the emotion is that you begin to expand. Because identification of the emotion has kept you caught in one little place. Suppose you've got a whole creation here, you draw it out as a big bubble. In a certain creation, you've got different places you are. So say consciousness is one little spot where you become limited within a whole creation. And outside that, there's
everything. Can you hold it up so everyone can
see? Try. Sorry, a little dot. Pretty clever picture, isn't it?
Yeah. Wait.
That's my artistic drawing here. So you've got a little dot, which is where you are. You've got
another side.
You've got the creation, and then you around that you've got everything. You often get stuck in one creation, which might be a certain situation you're in, which might be painful, might be difficult. And as you move around in that situation, you can feel different emotions. Over here you get angry, over there you get sad, over there you get depressed. Hi. And none of these are really separate from the creation. If you separate them, you try and deal with only the emotion at a time. It doesn't work because you find yourself flitting around. So we don't try and fix say one emotion. If it moves around, that's fine. You welcome everything. So you'll find yourself in a position in a creation. The creation might be that, you know, something like a bad relationship you're in that's painful. Sometimes you feel pain, sometimes you feel despair, sometimes you feel angry. You feel different emotions when you focus in there. Once you start welcoming the emotions, you expand from this point and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You're moving outwards. You're going to feel different emotions of anger and pain and so on until you get right to the edge of the creation where you begin to disassociate. Rather than being in the emotion, now looking at this whole thing. Therefore, there's no longer emotion there. You're looking at the whole thing without judgment where you can label it. You might label it this, then it's a difficult relationship. Now, if you think this is a big pile of shit, then that's if you're still in the emotion. You're not at the edge yet. So you're not ready to discreate it. You carry on welcoming until you've got to the edge where you see the whole creation without judgment. That's the point where you begin to dissociate and you can see, ah, this isn't me. This is my creation. Then when you allow it to discreate, it all fades away and it's gone because you've gone out and finished with it. That's how discreation happens normally. Now, normally, this might take years. You experience something in life and you spend years experiencing it. Until you've got to a point where you've done it all and you label it, dissociate, and it fades away. That's what people do in their lives. And often it takes years. But if you're conscious, you can do it within minutes. Or sometimes maybe an hour or two. Depends on how much emotion is in the situation. But basically we have to learn to do that consciously. You start by not identifying the emotion. You recognise, this is not me, this is emotion, I can feel that. You welcome it. Within that emotion, as you expand by welcoming, you experience other emotions which are part of the same creation. You get to a point where you get to the edge when you realise you can see a whole picture and realise this isn't me, this is my creation. You permit it to discreate and watch it fade away. You don't have to do anything to destroy it. It just fades away because you're no longer creating it. That's the thing about creation. You're creating all the time. You don't have to stop. You don't have to destroy something you don't want in your life. You simply stop creating it. All these emotions you're holding in place are keeping that state and that thing in a constant state of creation. When you stop creating it, it simply fades away. So you don't have to fight with reality this way. You simply welcome, expand, dissociate and discreate. So you only have to remember the conscious does three things. Creates, experiences, discreates. There's lots of things you already created. What you're doing now in the healing is experiencing as all these memories and emotions come up. So it's going to happen when you stop pressing points. All these memories come up from the bottom upwards. Numbness, apathy, grief, fear, anger, pain, and back to enthusiasm. And you realise that through that process, there's different levels of memory. When you're in apathy, you probably don't have the memories yet. You just feel, in general, that you want to give up because everything's too difficult. The time you get to pain, it's a very clear memory. You know exactly what happened, and that's why it hurts. So there's memories in stages. You don't have to remember everything to begin with. You don't have to go through the layer. Whatever you're feeling first is that where you need to be. You don't have to try and get to another emotion. And this is where people go wrong in therapy. Take something like depression, which is with the apathy. Nobody knows how to deal with that because it's depressing. See, when you go to the therapist with anger, they say, oh yeah, we can get into this one, get some juice out of it. But if you go down to see your therapist about depression, they usually get depressed too. You can't get enthusiastic about your depression usually. You have to start by welcoming it. Exactly where you are is where you need to welcome. When you feel depression, you welcome the depression. You feel the apathy and the giving up, you just welcome that enthusiastically until you move through and you get to the grief. In that process, you recognise why the depression there is in the first place. You gave up. After too much grief, when you closed the tears down, got too much, you stopped crying and you simply went into depression. Because those tears got blocked, they still want to come out somewhere, you ran out of energy. So first you experience all that depression, all the giving up, until the tears come back. Once it's cleansed, it's all out. So quite often when you come out of one emotion, you go to the next. It doesn't stop, does it? So you can start with numbness, then the apathy, then the grief, and so on. By the end of the week, you should have got to the end. But at first, if you feel nothing but apathy and unconsciousness, that's exactly what you need to feel. Because those are actually the most debilitating emotions. Don't be too keen to get to the juicy emotions, just because they're more fun. You'd have to be screaming and shouting if you don't get angry. That comes later. And by that time, you'll be used to handling it. You'll just welcome it and it'll pass. At first, when you feel numbness and apathy, that's what you welcome. So when you're holding your points, you're going numb everywhere and anesthetic's coming up. That's exactly what you need to feel. That's what happened the first day. Everybody's going to be going really numb and unconscious, trying to stay awake. And you even smell anesthetics in the room as it leaves people's bodies. If you had anesthetics in you, they come out. If you've been drunk, it all comes out. Taking drugs, it all comes out. Anything that's numbed you out will come out. The interesting thing about that, when you release anesthetics, quite often then you can experience the pain of the operation that was suppressed. You'll feel the cut, the burn of that cut and everything as it heals. But then the operation starts to heal. Everything heals when you release the suppressed memory. The only reason it doesn't heal is because you're suppressing things. So it's the opposite way of normal medicine. We don't suppress pain, we bring it all out. So it's no good trying to take a pill to suppress pain when the pain comes up. You want to welcome it. If you've broken a bone, for instance, if you press points on that broken bone, you feel the pain. The bone can knit within a couple of hours. I've done this many times. But we don't give you something to suppress it, we intensify it. Hold the bone together where it's broken, it's very, very painful. You'll feel the ache and it burns as the cannulina rises and it heals. Same with operations. When you get to the pain point of pain, when you've gone through the numbness and everything and the pain comes out to release anaesthetic, you feel the cut. You feel the burning of that cut inside it. You actually experience that. When it burns, the cannulina rises, the scar heals. So it's all about releasing suppressed memory. When you do that, the body will heal. Now, of course, healing the body does require a lot of nutrients, which is why you have to be in a good nutritional program to start with. Not just healing the body, but the release of emotions is also a chemical process. Remember, it's stored in crystals in the body. Now, when you express the emotion with enthusiasm, the pineal gland produces a hormone-like substance that starts dissolving those crystals. So enthusiasm is the key. Enthusiasm has been the natural state before you suppress emotions. We have to try and bring it back to trigger the whole release of emotions, which means that everything you feel, you're going to learn to be enthusiastic about. So when you're working in groups, the job of the people who are holding your points is to help keep the enthusiasm up, which means you don't get much sympathy. When you go through the emotions, they simply say, well, that's wonderful, I really feel that. Because sympathy will just drag you down to wallow in it. That's not what you want. We don't do sympathy. You have compassion, empathy, yes, that's not sympathy. But also you've got to realise what glues the illusion together with seriousness. So I'm trying to remind you, as metaphysics and as well as quantum physics keeps showing you, that this world is illusory, it's not really physical. It's all just energy. It's all illusion. But we make it stuck in that illusion by being serious. When you're serious, it's because you really believe in the illusion. Now, it doesn't mean you can just joke about somebody's pain. What the antidote to seriousness is actually appreciation. Appreciation that this is a God who's creating the reality perfectly. Whatever pain they've created, they've done that perfectly. We can sit there in wonder and appreciation of that creation. You release the seriousness. Now you can try this. It doesn't matter what you say. It's about the attitude you hold. When somebody's going through all this stuff and you're simply sitting there in appreciation, it's very hard for them to remain serious about it. It loosens it up. But they can actually start releasing the emotions rather than making it too real. That's an important point in every coming depth of spiritual point. None of this is real. We make it real, and the final thing that glues it all together is our seriousness. Doesn't mean you're going to be daft. It means you're going to hold in a state of appreciation, wonder at that creation. Now, there are times it's not appropriate to say things, like, for instance, you know, if somebody's going through a major trauma, and you say, you know, telling them, oh, you've created all that, hope we want to hit you. Because that's the wrong time to say it. You know, they want healing first, they want support. You can talk about metaphysics later. So the main thing is to have that space we hold in appreciation, just so they can actually allow those emotions without making them too real. You can actually support them through all the different emotions, go through all the pain, the disempowerment and all those other things. The other exercise you can do along the way, deal with various certain problems they've been through, we'll deal with those later. The first thing is to learn to welcome everything. Welcome every emotion that's been suppressed. And your place as the healer is simply to hold that appreciation and enthusiasm so that they feel you can encourage them to bring it out. I said it's not about sympathy, it's about enthusiasm. So whatever they're going through, say, that's wonderful. Really feel that. And somebody's in all their anger and pain, great, fantastic, feel it. Because the more enthusiasm you give them, the faster they're going to release. All the emotion comes piling up fast, and they get to the other end, it's all out, and they change. They move on to the next emotion. Now, you never stop. Even when you've gone all those layers up to love, you can release that and get to a higher love. There's no ceiling on this.
There's no?
No ceiling on it. No stop. Whatever you welcome and release, you move upwards from it. So even when you got to the love and enthusiasm, you welcome and release it. And there's even greater love. It doesn't stop. But at first, when you're stuck in the apathy and numbness, that's what you're welcoming. And each thing you welcome and release, you find you move upscale, the vibration increases. And you can see it changing through the body when you look at the iris. The gonads heal first, then the spleen, then the pancreas, then the thymus, then the thyroid, then the pituitary, then the pineal. You're going to watch the body changing by looking at the iris. So we diagnose with the iris in this because that shows structural changes in the body. We'll talk about that later as we get into the diagnostics. We're going to begin just by understanding that process of healing, that when your points are being held, emotions are going to come up and you're going to welcome them. And after you welcome them, you just let them pass. That simple. You get used to the process. It's actually quite easy. When you put a process to be simple, but when you first try and do it, you don't know how to do it because you're not used to it. Once you get used to it, it's very simple. Every emotion comes, you welcome it, you move on. Remember this, and then you also use it in your process of creation. Anytime you're going to create something, like you're visualizing something, you want to get rich, you get a new house, whatever it is, you put that thought out. Now, how long do you think it takes to actually create something, a visualization? A lot of people tell you about visualize something and happen, but how long? Do you know? 33 seconds. Because that's how long it takes for the neurons in the brain to fire. If you visualise something in 33 seconds without feeling, that's how long it takes for all the neurons to fire, the image is released, goes to the universe to be created. Anything more than that is to do the resistance. If you think you've got to visualise an hour a day to get anything done, look at what beliefs are behind that. Look at what resistance you've still got. What people are often doing is spend too much time concentrating on creation. They're not dealing with all the emotions which says you can't do it. So what happens? Do 33 seconds of visualization, see what comes up. If the apathy comes up, thinking you can't do it, welcome that and let it go. When that's gone, come back to your 33 seconds again. See what else comes up. When there's nothing else coming up, there's just a feeling it's going to happen, it'll happen. Creation is really that easy because it's all illusion. But there's another point with creation. If you know it's an illusion, it's easy to shape it. The things you make real are things that are harder to change. And different people make different things real in this world. Some people make their health real. Might be good at metaphysics, creating all these things all their life. As soon as they get ill, they rush to the doctor and you do the same old stuff instead of actually just creating that disease. Some people, their job's real. They can do anything else, but they can't affect their career or create money. Some people have less sheep as well. They can change anything else, but they can't change the people. You hear a lot, don't you? You can't change people. Well, why not their illusion too? But there's a trick with people, because you want to make them will to have intimacy. So you might have this idea that everything is my creation. And if I'm close to somebody, I want to think that they're really love me. It's not just me creating that. So if I'm looking like a little hand in the glove puppet saying, oh, I love you. So therefore, we have to make people will, because that allows intimacy. So you have to find where you draw the line as to how real to make them, but not too real. You make people real enough to have intimacy, but not too real that you can't change them. Actually, you do change everybody around you by who you are. Not by forcing them to change. Judgment is going to work. In the presence of love, you will change. That's what you're doing, applying this antiresism, unconditional love. Everybody grows. It doesn't try and make people grow because they're not good enough. It's not saying you've got to change. It's not saying don't change, I love you as you are. You're saying, I love you as you are, but through my love, you become more. When you're putting out love, people grow. Love is an important part of this, so we need to discuss love, because there's too many things in the world which pretend to be love that are not. So when somebody is loving, you have to look at what love does to know how it works. What does love do? First of all, it creates safety. It creates value. It creates pleasure. It creates a sense of being known. A sense of celebration. A sense of becoming more. If you're doing those things, you're loving. If you're not, you're not being loving. People make too many excuses, like say, okay, they might take your self-worth down and say, but I love you. As if that's okay. It doesn't make it okay because it's not love. People have all kinds of excuse to behaviour. And love often becomes an excuse rather than being real. You might see this. You get a lot of the New Agers who get too much caught in these principles without being responsible for them. They'll try and tell you all these home truths because they want to get off their chest, but they'll tell you that they love you. As if that makes it okay, therefore you should listen to them. But if you recognise this isn't love because they're not helping your self-worth, they're tearing you down, you don't listen to it, it's not love. If they're not making you feel safe, it's not love. You don't grab somebody and say, what, you're going to be healed now, do go through this. You're not creating a safe place. If you're loving them, they'll release naturally. First, it's safe. In order to release all these emotions, they've got to feel safe. They won't be judged. You won't go through emotions without being judged, will you? If people tell you this is bad, you don't want to feel it. And people have all kinds of things to hold us bad, so don't be afraid, that's weak. Don't be angry, you're not being a nice person. Well, no, they're just emotions, they're not who you are. Of course you can feel fear and anger and anything else you like. So, you know, if you love them while they're being angry, well, that's love, you know. It's not saying, you know, I don't like you now because you're angry. You've got to get rid of the judgments. Remember, anger is letting them be as they are. So you say, yep, I love you being angry too. You get enthusiastic about the anger because you want to get it out. See, that's why you're saying, wonderful, love that anger. Love is not judging. It's making them feel safe. They feel okay about being angry. It's not being criticised for being angry. Not being made to feel bad because they're angry. What are these judgments there to control you? When somebody's saying it's bad to be angry, what they're really saying is, don't be assertive because I want to carry on walking all over you. Because when you're angry, you're assertive. People don't let you be angry because you're stopping from walking all over you. You're setting your boundaries. You should know when you're with your real friends, you know, when somebody loves you, they don't mind you being angry, do they? They're often supporting you to be angry. That's what you do when you're healing. If you want to be angry, that's wonderful. Same with anything. If you feel afraid, you don't say, oh no, that's weak. No, no, it's okay to be afraid. It's okay to cry. All these emotions are real. They're just emotions. And it's like you love the person anyway, because the emotion isn't them. You love them while they're sad. You don't say, no, I don't like you now, I'm going to push you away. Only come back and I'll love you when you're being good. That isn't love. That's not loving the person as they are. That's loving a concept of what you want them to be. That's manipulation. When you really look, a lot of people in the world are not really loving a person. They're loving an image of what they want them to be, and quite often it's their own genetic material. Like with children. How many parents disown their children when they're not behaving themselves? I'm not saying, I don't love you. I love this, my genetic material, I want you to be like me. This is my genes being passed on, that's why I love it. As soon as you stop doing what I want you to do, I'm going to disown you. That's not love. That's simply protecting your own genetic material and survival. Be with the same relationships. I'll love you while I'm being good, and then when you get angry, I'm going to stop loving you. That's not love. When you love the person as they are. There's no judgment. Whether they're angry, fearful, sad, whatever. It doesn't change. The reason you close those things is because you're not dealing with your own emotions. So when somebody else is going through it, it triggers yours, and you want to push them away because you're not comfortable with them. And you'll find that the shadow works this way. Everything you push inside will come at you from the outside. Good or bad, if you suppress your anger, you're going to be surrounded by angry people. If you deny your creativity, you're going to be surrounded by creative people. All reflecting you, and one has to understand one's shadow in order to deal with this. What happens when you deny your shadow, say the light side of the shadow, which is the creativity? You end up with envy. All people come to you trying to show you what you're hiding inside is your creativity. You feel envious of because you're denying your creativity. And all the people who come reflecting angry, you want to push away because you don't like feeling angry. They're tricking your feelings. So it's important to understand the nature of shadow. The shadow is diametrically opposed to the ego. To understand how they work together, pure awareness has no judgment, it's everywhere. What you might call the creator God isn't everything. Only when we become limited do we then start creating concepts of quantity or quality or anything else, which limits the nature of the creator. It's pure awareness. Let's say to compare something like an anthill in a solar system. Looking at quantity, the conscious like to say, no, the solar system is far greater than the anthill. Looking at complexity, oh no, this anthill is more complex than the solar system. So you start making judgment that this is more than that. But actually, the creator is in both. Not by any amount, but totally. Creator does not portion itself, it's in everything totally. Equally in the solar system and in the anthill, because it's beyond any concept of quantity or quality. What happens when we make judgments? We separate into an ego and a shadow. The ego is always saying, I'm better than that. The shadow is saying, that is me. So when you surround the people around you, you can actually be aware what you're going to respond from, ego or shadow. Sometimes being emotional, you don't like it, you say, well, no, this is all wrong, that's weak, you're not being nice. That's ego. Say, I'm not comfortable with this, rather than saying that's a reflection of me, I'll separate and say I'm better than that. Shadow says, this is me. If I'm feeling uncomfortable with those emotions, because I'm not being with my own emotions, therefore, when this is supposed to be emotional, I get emotional as well, that's good. You use that. This will happen when you hold healing. When somebody else is getting emotional, you may find it triggers your emotions too, and that's great. Everybody can get emotional together, and it all comes out. Maybe you can start screaming and crying everywhere and get it all out. If one person is doing it, you say, no, I don't like that, and judge them, they're going to close down. The fact is, you go through it together. If you're not judging them, but actually embracing shadow, you encourage them as well as yourself to grow. If you're an ego and saying, no, this is wrong, I'm better than that, they'll close down, you won't deal with your own emotions. You're not helping. Do you understand here that you're not separate from everybody else? You encourage them to change when you are changing. And also, by seeing them as a reflection, you grow too. That's the Hawaiian principle of Ho'oponopono, seeing the other person the same as you. When you change you, you change them. So it comes up to yourself. If they trigger the emotion, you welcome that and change, they change too. So a big part of your healing is also dealing with your own stuff. So when you're holding somebody else's points, they get emotional, you feel emotional, that's okay. Don't think you've got to take your attention off and just deal with them. You're a part of the process. While you're healing, you can go through emotions too. It's not one-sided in healing. Whether you're receiving or giving, you're still healing yourself. You might be sitting there holding the other person's points, helping them, but they're also helping you. It works both ways. But you want to experience both sides, giving and receiving, in order to be whole with this process. When you're helping the person to grow and watch them changing, it'll trigger your changes too. You'll grow together. If you hold back because you think you're giving them attention, you won't encourage them to grow. They'll be holding back too. So whatever is there, let it out. Welcome it. It's not about screaming and shouting. You can if you want to, but you know, it's simply about welcoming. When you feel angry, welcoming it. If you have to shout, that's okay, but you don't have to. Important thing is to learn to welcome emotions. See, because some people do too much shouting, not really welcoming, they're avoiding still. The screaming and shouting is a distraction to actually feeling. The important thing is simply to feel. You welcome each emotion as it comes up. You don't have to try and get through the motion you think you ought to do. Some people come with the concept, no, there's anger inside, they want to get it out. Well, actually, before it comes out, it might be numbness, apathy, grief, everything else. Whatever comes up is what you're going to experience. The rest will come later. Whatever you feel now is right. You start with what you've got and you welcome it, and then you'll move on to the next one. Any questions so far?
Sure.
Okay. Did you get all that, though?
I got some.
Okay, well, we'll be doing it anyway.
Can you go over that when the holding points, how it works as in keeping one vigit on?
We're getting to that. We're going to look at the actual how we do it now.
When you talk about the DNA producing these crystals, why does it do that? Is there any evolutionary kind of reason for that?
Yes. Everything adapts to its environment, to the body. Now, when you look at evolution, first of all, let's get rid of Darwin's theory, because it's certainly wrong. It's been disproved many, many times. Things don't evolve gradually. They happen in sudden mutations. Most modern theories of evolution are based on Pigagin's work. Now, Pigagin was a mathematician. His work was with open systems. An open system is anything which is independent, yet still interacts with its environment. It might take a little specificity again. Say you've got a barrier, which is flexible. Various things bounce around in it. As they bounce off each other and off their surface, they create a certain pattern that continues. That would be a closed system, but if you've got other things interacting with this barrier, which influence what's inside, all this input changes the pattern of what's inside in its movement. It's not just for living things, it's a simple mathematical puzzle. Now, if the input increases and it overwhelms what's inside, all these movements around, the whole pattern will break down because it's overwhelmed. But then, because of those input coming in, there's still movement. After being overwhelmed and breaking down completely, it starts a new pattern, which is nothing like the old one. It's not connected linearly or causally. It's simply been influenced by its environment and adapts to cope with that new input. Now, it's not just living things, that happens to a mathematical puzzle. That's the base for everything. So when it comes to living things, they follow the same pattern. The environment is overwhelming you, you break down, and out of that you reorganise to a higher level with these things no longer overwhelming. You've changed. That's how evolution works. How that works in the DNA then, all these different patterns being stored as crystals of the DNA through your emotions. Now, it's only humans who do that. I've seen this in how animals adapt to emotions by feeling them. For instance, when I was a kid, I used to see the train going by where the cow field was. A young cow would really be shaking when the train went by. But it would have a good shake, get all out of the system. Didn't suppress it. Therefore, it didn't shake anymore. It adapted. Got strong and it wasn't bothered by the train anymore. People tend to want to shut off their feelings. If somebody's shaking, they'll give you medication. Mm. You don't deal with it, you don't adapt. These memories go into crystals stored in the DNA to be dealt with later. They'll even be passed on genetically because it's in the DNA. Means your children are born with those weaknesses. It gets passed on. So that way, the same pattern starts working negatively. That's why you get hereditary diseases. The problems are being passed on in the DNA. Now, if you weren't suppressing things, then what happens then as this input comes in, it is going to change how your body works, right down to the DNA. Because the DNA is dealing with these automatic survival mechanisms, how the body responds to stimuli. It simply will respond and change because it's been broken down and reorganised at a higher level. Which means in the evolutionary crisis, you'd have a big breakdown. And then you come out different. You can see this pattern all the time in things like butterflies, which go through metamorphosis. They go into a little cocoon, but they're completely back to liquid. You know, if you open it up and it's inside, it'll be liquid, it's all totally broken down, then it grows into something totally new, which is nothing like the old one. Huge difference between a butterfly and a caterpillar, isn't there? Now, there's a certain hormone which produces that change, causes that metamorphosis. I can't remember what it's called now. But the only other species which has that hormone, apart from caterpillars, is humans. We actually have the same hormone which creates metamorphosis. Hmm. Which means when there is a future crisis, you have the ability to change and become different, become new. Hmm. Other animals seem to change anyway, but not the same point as a level of metamorphosis as a caterpillar into a butterfly. We have great potential to change. This is why we don't have higher faculties, which can, you know, have all these different spiritual powers as well, which allow you to control your life. Because we are here to create our reality. When these higher faculties develop, so you can actually work your magic and the, what you call the cities, so you can do everything far better. And this is an evolutionary change. Your DNA changes. At first, the DNA changes simply getting rid of these crystals to get them to a pure DNA, which has the potential to do anything. After that, it actually evolves. It changes so it's no longer looks like human DNA anymore. That's why a lot of people get tested and they think, oh, you're not human. DNA's changed. I got this all the time, even when I was in the jungle. First thing a dog named Steamer said to me is, I can tell by your voice, you're not from this world. You're not human. I was like, yeah, I couldn't. It took hard to figure out what it was, but yeah. I said, I'm not human, okay. It's all right. The human normal definition of human is simply what they've judged as normal when they've taken normal DNA of somebody who hasn't actually grown yet. Because most people are stuck in not growing, because that's how society is formed. It's rigid. You stay in this box, you're outside the box, there's something wrong with you. So the whole structure of society is not allowing evolution because they want you to be the same. The way to fit in, do the same old jobs to keep society running. And that's a big part of the problem. See, society was formed with three initial purposes. Society has three initial purposes. One, it's supposed to protect you from chaos. Two, it has to fulfill your needs. But thirdly, it has to survive on its own. The problem is, the surviving on its own has taken over the other two. It's no longer fulfilling your needs. It's protecting you from chaos to a degree, but it's protecting you from the good chaos as well. But chaos is good, it changes. You know, if everything is structured in order, you don't change. Whenever something changes, there's chaos. When people want to be in control all the time, they don't like chaos. When you're afraid, you don't want chaos because you don't know what's going to come. But receiving is chaos, isn't it? You're not in control when you're receiving something. Something gives you something. That could be one reason why some people can't receive. It's chaos. You're not in control of it anymore. Yet when you receive, things improve. It's good. You change, actually. You change when you let yourself be loved. That's the important point. As I said, when you love, people change. So, when you allow yourself to be loved, you change. So when you change because you're loved, that's what causes the evolution. That's what it means to be vulnerable to love. To be vulnerable to love is to change because you're loved. Vulnerability is something else people push away when they want control. Because when you're not in control, when there's chaos, you're vulnerable. You are changing in a way that your mind is not in control of. When you change, you're not in control of how you change. You know you're going to evolve into something higher, but you're not in control. You're going to be vulnerable. But vulnerability is something that gets a bad name, because people are usually thinking about vulnerability to abuse when somebody's hurting you. Now, you don't want to be vulnerable to abuse, but you do want to be vulnerable to love. You want to be vulnerable to your own power. You want to be vulnerable to the goddess. Because power works by resonance, not by impact. The mechanical view of the universe, from Newtonian physics, has seen being able to push it along, causing to effect. Therefore, power is measured by pushing things along, impact. The stronger one pushing out the weaker. But that's not how creation works. It's due to the resonance, because it's energy. Waves don't push each other along. They combine to produce a new wave, which changes both. To understand the resonance, right now this very room is filled with all the love the goddess has for you, all the love your higher self has for you. Your personal resonance depends on, shows how much of that love you're receiving. You can't force the goddess to love you more because she already loves you totally. You change your resonance and you receive more of that love, and therefore you change and your whole life changes. It's not forceful. To grow, you have to be vulnerable. First of all, you're vulnerable to the loves that you change. In that process, you're also going to be vulnerable to your power, your higher self, your relationship to God, Goddess, all this. It's vulnerability. It's not about force. We don't measure power by pushing people around and trying to be strongest. That's an ego game. That's called a Newtonian physics, which is false. That's something else that's totally disproven. You see, cause is in the future, not the past. Look at anything you do. It wasn't caused by a past. Is caused by where you're going. When you get up this morning, so you want to get here an hour later or whatever time it long, you know, it's always the future that makes you move. You didn't get up in the morning because something happened in the past made you get up in the morning. You got up because you wanted to do something. Everything you do has a motivation. When you look at it in quantum physics, every experience is a quantum wave, a double quantum wave, between here and the future. If something doesn't have a future, you can't experience it. We're constantly in a state of becoming. The past doesn't come into the equation. That's just the backdrop we use to explain ourselves more fully. You often use the past to explain who you are, which is trying to give a picture. It's not cause for anything. What actually happens is that you first decide an effect, and then you go back and add a cause. Now, in our past, we've got loads and loads of possible causes for anything you want, when you look at it. How many thoughts do you have in a day? Can you count them? Somebody's counted it, several thousand, can't remember exactly how many, but it's a lot. How many days have you had in your life? You've got millions and billions of thoughts in your backdrop that you can actually use to act as a cause for anything you want. But you pick them out selectively. Pick out a cause and back there, okay, my mother said I'll never amount to anything, I'll use that to punish her for years to come. You'll tell it, you talk about how horrible your mother was and get all the emotions out, you're using that. Might have another thought over there, my mother said don't have sex before marriage. Well, not listen to that one because there's no fun in it. So we select the thoughts from our past and use them as causes for what we want to achieve. But first of all, we've chosen the effect first, then we're back and added the cause. The real reason you do anything is because of the future. Let's take a simple example of a behaviour like self-pity. Why is somebody in self-pity? Any clues? What does self-pity do? One thing, it gets to avoid things. If somebody's in self-pity, we've got responsibilities, they say, leave me alone. You think, okay, I'll leave you alone right now because you're feeling sorry for yourself. You don't expect to do anything, they avoid those responsibilities. Secondly, it manipulates. It gets people to treat with kid gloves. So you treat them the way they want you to treat. Thirdly, it punishes. We're with somebody in self-pity and they can't make them feel better, you feel bad. It tears down your self-worth, which is the best way to destroy somebody's life, is to tear their self-worth down. It's punishment. But if he admitted it, it wouldn't work. So if I'm sitting here feeling sorry for myself and you come over and say, what's the matter? And I say, I'm manipulating you. You're not going to have it. So I've got to nobilize my past to make it real. So I say, oh, I've been having a hard time. My wife been giving me a hard time. My mother gave me a hard time. My boss gave me a hard time. Then you feel sorry for me, I've got you eating out of my hand right where I want you. That's why you do it. It's to do with the future, not the past. We've added the past later. We've gone back and given it a cause. But it's false. This is what's important to realise about it. You won't change just by changing your past. A lot of people work on the past a lot, going through regression therapies and all sorts. After a while, it seems to be producing limited returns, doesn't it? Because you haven't got to the point where you're creating that past too. Or how you're using that past for the future you're creating. The whole process of creation requires a bit more responsibility than that. You've got to look at the future you're building and your relationship to that and how use the past as a part of that picture. So first of all, get your attention to come in here. Hopefully you're here because you want to heal. If you come in here to feel sorry for yourself, to prove nothing works, it won't work, because that's how you create. We create our own reality, right? So if for instance, you only do this work to prove it doesn't work, it won't, which proves that it does. Because you get what you want. It's not always what you say you want. That's why you have to clarify your intention. Do you want to heal? Do you want your future to be different? The fact is, we can't change the past. We can create a better future. You can forgive the past and be done with it. We can't change it. It's gone. Why should you want to? It's not there anyway. It doesn't exist anymore. Why do you need to change the past? You don't need to justify it either. It's gone. What you want to do is create a better future. So you have your intention in mind. Do you want to get better? Do you want to be healthier? Do you want to be happier, more successful, more powerful? Of all the things you want. Well, that requires you to change. I'm not going to create success while being in self-pity. Because if I'm successful, how's it even going to feel sorry for me? You can't manipulate when you're successful because people don't feel sorry for you anymore. You don't get to avoid responsibility when you're powerful. So you can look at the agendas here. Do you really want to change? What's it going to look like in the future when you're healthy and powerful and successful? You have to give up the manipulations and the self-pity. They won't work, you can't have them. So the first thing is, what do you want in your future? That'll motivate you to change. Just look at the whole picture, you know. You cannot carry on manipulating people when you're successful. You're creating, you don't need to manipulate. It takes far more energy to manipulate people to do things for you than it does to create it all yourself. Just look at times you've been in self-pity and trying to get people to do things around you. It takes a lot of energy, doesn't it? Actually, creation is easy. I said it only takes 33 seconds when you got it right, once you've got the crap out of the way. Thing is, getting all that crap out of the way, all your past creations keep asserting themselves because you haven't finished with them. Just welcome them, let it all go, and it's all gone. That simple. And you're going to get faster with it. So practically then, now we're going to work on this. What are the prison points? So because a lot of these, all these different emotions and memories are stored in the body's little crystals in the DNA, and they resonate with different endocrine glands. So you've got numbness in the gonads, apathy in the spleen, grief in the solar plexus, pancreas, and adrenal, fear in the thymus, anger in the thyroid, pain in the pituitary, and enthusiasm in the pineal gland. So when you see the blocks in the body, we press the appropriate reflex points and those emotions start flowing out. While holding those points, you stay enthusiastic to encourage the person. But to add that, we're going to add some what I call empowerments or transmissions to activate the energy within you, to activate the kundalini. What is the kundalini really? It's love in action. Simple as that. The action is an important part of this, understand. A lot of people say they love, but they don't do anything about it. Love and will have to be balanced. One of the laws of magic, love and will. You see, these two often get separated when you're a child, simply because you learn that when your parents are willful, they say no. When they're loving, they say yes. Think about that.
Can you repeat what you just said, please?
That when you're a child, you should learn from your parents that when they're loving, they say yes. When they're willful, they say no. So love and will get separated. You're either loving or willful. Look how this affects you later in life. An example in relationships. Somebody's willful until they fall in love and they turn to a mush and people walk all over them. Boundaries go. Because the love and the will are not working together. When you get it right, will gives direction and definition to love, and love gives depth and meaning to the will. So your love might say, oh, I love everybody right now, but not do anything about it. Will is a bit which says, right now, I'm loving you in this particular way, so it's actually getting somewhere. No, I'm actually doing something that's helpful. That's love in action. Kundalini is also love in action. When the energy is rising, it's because this love has a dynamism to it which makes change. So you can't actually raise kundalini while being shut away and unloving. When you open to the power of love in the universe and it flows through you, it is active and it changes. So there are things we can do to awaken kundalini, but you've got to let it in by being willing to act with love. This is what you're doing when you're healing. Simply holding their space, loving them, whatever they're going through. It's not difficult. It doesn't take much energy really. You think about it, just sit there and just love them. But energy flows. Kundalini rises, it all gets very hot. Your fingers are going to burn. You might even get blisters on them, but if you don't resist, they heal really fast. If you resist, it feels very painful. What you're going to realise is that that pain is simply a resistance. When you don't resist it, it's just an energy flow. It's the burning of the kundalini, which is purifying you. When you don't understand, you panic, you resist things, because you don't know that it's doing you good. When you're holding points, the fingers are getting very, very hot. Love it. It's all changing you. It's healing you as well as them. Now, that heat is going to change through the week, because when you're first going through numbness, you don't feel it so much because you're numb. You'll know when the session has ended because of what's happening in your fingers. First it'll get very numb. It'll get very hot at some point as well. And it'll start pulsing at the end. Now, when you measure your pulse, or their pulse, pulsing in the finger is not the same. It's a different pulse altogether. And when you measure it, it pulses at 72 beats per minute. It's a kind of universal pulse that's to do with the energy of the universe. It's not your pulse. So this throbbing or pulsing feeling at the end, that's when it's finishing. When the pulsing has stopped, the session is over. Burning is when you're breaking down the old crystals. Pulsing is when you're restructuring new tissue as what is becoming aligned to a new pattern of creation. There's like a divine blueprint that exists which reminds you of how you were before you had any karma. There's this pen of perfection of how you can be when all your cities developed, all your powers, all your spiritual abilities, how you can function fully as a god. That pattern already exists, and that's something else we're kind of transmitting as a way to remind you. That is represented by the Sri Yantra and the Tantra. preempt actually holds that pattern of divinity and its meaning.
So
when I actually, when we're tuning in first and first tuning in the healing, that's one of the things they're giving us, the Sriyantra enduement, which actually brings this divine blueprint to mind your body and your consciousness how it can be when it's perfected. When you know, when your body knows what it can be, it can release all the old karma more easily and come back to its perfection. Kundalini is also revising in stages. Each session will get a little bit higher. Don't want to burn you up completely in one go, that can be dangerous. The process of Chandalia is a system of raising Kundalini safe stages. As you release different resistances, you can go a little bit higher each time. So it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. So it will get hot when you're holding points. Once you've got rid of all the unconsciousness, you really feel the heat. It's going to burn. That's all part of the process. So it gets numb, it burns, it pulses, and it's finished. When it's not pulsing, you let go, it's over. The session can take a couple of hours, so you're going to get yourself comfortable because you're going to be there for a while. But basically, we're holding points. Just holding on while I do the transmissions that come to your eyes. Then all you're going to do is keep a state of enthusiasm while I go through their stuff. Simple, really, isn't it?
What if we're getting attached to their stuff and how are you going to not care if someone's...
Oh, it's not that you don't care. It's that you have empathy and compassion, but not sympathy. You do that simply by holding enthusiasm. Keep that state, you know, of appreciation. Learn to see the person as a god. They create all that wonderfully. And then you have the enthusiasm at the post of release, so that what they're going through is wonderful. It's great that they're releasing it. That's how you feel positive. You know, it's healing. So when they're getting angry, you say, wonderful! But you won't get caught into sympathy and pity.
But what if you don't feel?
You will, because you're going to get Kundalini going and you're going to start letting love in.
Okay.
It's all about love.
All right.
Which love isn't from you, it comes through you. You only have to let it in and be willing.
Can I?
And we all have love. Don't you have enough?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's all you need.
Can I point out that a lot of times what people will actually experience is what the other person is going through as well?
That's true.
Because we actually reflect.
Actually, not quite. It's more that the person triggers similar stuff in you. If somebody's going through stuff and you start feeling something, it is yours. So welcome it. So, you know, if you're holding a person, you start getting angry, that's okay too, welcome it. You start with the love. Well, it's an interesting point. So I first learnt in meditation years ago, because when I in my younger days, one of the first things I did was TM. You know, you remember the old Maharishis, transcendental meditation, you just do a mantra. Well, he used to get into all this research where he puts these little things around your head to measure your brain waves and all that, so I was always doing research into effects of meditation. I was back in my college days many years back. And there was one woman who came in one day after measuring her brain, which was saying, don't use my results, I just couldn't meditate today. My mind was all over the place. And I said, that's funny. I was about to tell you, yours is the deepest state ever recorded. They said to her, that's funny, because I was about to tell you, your state was the deepest state ever recorded. That's when she thought she wasn't meditating, her mind was all over the place. What actually happens is you go deep, all the rubbish comes up. It shows the process is working. So you start by loving, and all this crap comes up, that's okay. Part of the process. Same thing. You don't have to stay. Well, you stay loving in a way, but doesn't know the rest. If you start with love and you start getting really angry and fearful and everything else, you're welcome. That's wonderful. You learn to love that too, rather than love instead of it. Love doesn't deny the rest; it embraces them. So you love the fact that you're angry. Love the fact that you're sad. Whatever else comes up. Love the fact that you hate somebody. You love hating. So okay, you can feel love and hate at the same time. We get enthusiastic about the hate and really feel you want to kill somebody. You don't go and kill them, but you can feel it. It's okay to feel you want to kill somebody. When you really welcome it, it passes. It may be in some situations it's not over until you've dealt with something with the person. It doesn't mean killing them, but you must maybe need to assert yourself in some way because they've been putting you down and taking your power away and you've learned to take your power back. Get to that later, but the first thing is to welcome everything. We start with enthusiasm, we raise Kundalini. You just have to keep those principles in mind. Whatever they feel, you keep enthusiastic about and love them. And if you get angry and hateful or even tired and apathetic, these are all past feelings coming up to be cleared, so you simply welcome them. So it's okay, you know, so the first session you're holding there, you're going to go numb. You're going to feel like passing out and falling asleep. That's okay too. Love that. Love the fact that you feel totally sleepy and don't want to, can't be bothered. Love is a strange thing when you get into it, but you'll learn. But you know how to love. We all do. And the problem is, a lot of people think that love isn't good enough. What it is, it's love. The love you feel is good enough. It can create miracles. Again, this is a shame. People always tell you you're not good enough. Well, you are. You have love, and that's an amazing power. You have your imaginations. Imagination creates everything. Quite often people tell you, stop imagining things at school and, you know, concentrate on what's real. No, that's not real, it's illusion. Imagination is creating everything. When you have a wonderful vision in your meditation, how is that's just imagination? Well, what do you mean just imagination? It's the most powerful tool you've got. This is all imagination. The imagination, the whole, we're imagining the whole thing. So don't knock the imagination. It's powerful. So it's those simple things you have are powerful tools that you forget about. The love you feel is a powerful tool as well. It can transform everything. And it comes from the universe, and it's always there. Once you decide to let it in. And it will flow. You can do this. Of course, lots of things come, old thoughts and creations saying you can't. But you simply welcome those. It's what comes when you get to the apathy. It's all the I can'ts coming up. I can't do this. I'm not good enough. And that's another thing, shame. When you feel not good enough, it's because somebody's dumped shame on you. You've been told you're not good enough. That's not actually an important point we'll get to, because you might need this during your process. Some shame has to be given back because it's not yours. The thing about shame is it's not just an emotional problem, it's a metaphysical one. Which is why it doesn't get dealt with in therapy enough. It's an energy that can be passed on from one person to another. If somebody doesn't feel good enough about themselves and don't want to feel it, they give it to somebody else to carry it for them. That's the motivation for most abusive behaviour. But even with children, when they're being abused, it's because the parents feel ashamed and they think, well, you'll feel ashamed instead. No, I feel better. They've passed it on. All these things we've been told you're not good enough. There's a lot of shame being dumped on you. When you
How does that work? If you've actually got an energy within your system, yep. Say there's anger within a parent,
mm-hmm.
They pass it on. It's still going to be in their system, isn't it? It won't actually come out of their system.
No, but they're not feeling it anymore.
So it's almost creating more to pass
it does.
On, rather than
that's true.
You've just got theirs and they don't have it anymore.
Oh, they have it, but they're not feeling it.
Yeah.
Thing.
So that's just to clarify, because that's. Correct.
But when you give it back, they start feeling it, which means they can start changing. I've had this many times, you know, get someone to give a parent shame back to the parents, so the parents want to go therapy and change, because then they'll become aware of their shame and deal with it. Well, they're dumping it on other people, not dealing with it. It creates so it's like a dysfunctional pattern is increased. The shame is an energy that's moving around.
So it's the physical field of the body, because the transference is in the emotional field. So
you'll feel it in the body if you really look. If you think about it, if you go back to a point where you've been abused and somebody's dumped shame on you, if you really think about it in terms of shame, you'll feel an energy entering your body. You feel it in a certain place and it's heavy. What you do then, you simply squeeze it all out. You can imagine you've got a sack and squeeze from inside. And that is a bit like pushing a hard-boiled egg through a sieve. So you're going to get in a sieve and a hard-boiled egg, you'll know what it feels like. It's like when you squeeze shame out. So when you feel the shame, you squeeze it all out. It might take you a while to get it all out. In your meditation, you hand it back to them. So here, this is your shame. I'm not carrying it for you anymore. Deal with yourself. And you find that you feel released. You've changed. They've got it back and deal with it. You're not carrying the shame anymore. So you can do this with all the different situations where you've been told you're not good enough. Because this is what's holding you back a lot. This shame that's actually false. All the times you've been told you're not good enough. This happens in many hidden ways as well, like perfection standards. The parents might not be abusive in an obvious way, might bring you up with a high standard that you've got to live up to, and if you can't be perfect, you're not good enough. They're still not feeling good enough. By making you feel perfect, it's also already trying to pass on shame. What's happened? They weren't perfect. They don't feel good enough. Therefore, the child has to be, you know, wonderful to justify them. Which means that's another way of passing on shame. They don't feel good enough. You've got to be perfect, otherwise you're not good enough. See how that works? So also you've got to look for the hidden shame in things like perfection standards. It gets passed on in many ways. Anytime you've been made to feel not good enough by somebody else, they've dumped shame on you. So when it happens and you recognise this in your process, feel it in the body, squeeze it all out and give it back to them. And you get rid of all these thoughts not good enough. That's what, so that comes up with the apathy, that, you know, the not good enough stuff all comes out there, so it's going to happen a lot. So when you get to the apathy, you also have lots of shame you'll be clearing out. All these memories of basically not feeling good enough. Well, that's totally false, you know. I said, oh God, how are you not good enough? You're a creator, you can create anything. And they haven't really stopped you, it's simply that you've all these suppressed emotions, you've got these past creations trying to reassert themselves all the time. Once you let those out and change, you can create anything.